Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back. It's our first podcast, I think, recorded in 2021. Unfortunately, we had kind of a rocky start to 2021.
I think it feels kind of like everybody has.
With just what's going on in our country and really just the whole world with COVID, but specifically in our country with things happening in our country's capital. It's just been kind of a heavy week. But on a more personal level, it's just been a rough week. It started last Wednesday. Garrett got sick. He was vomiting.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the best way to...
I had a horrible headache, vomiting, and all that stuff. And
so, you know, COVID is basically... Symptoms of COVID are... Any sickness ever, any symptom possible could be a symptom of COVID. And so it was the day before Caleb was supposed to start back to preschool. And I was just like, Garrett, you've got to get tested because we can't take Caleb to school and then find out, you know, a week later or something that you have COVID and that maybe he gets COVID and exposes, you know, his teachers and his the other kids in his class. So Caleb didn't get to go back on his first day of school, and Garrett got tested, but, you know, there is a little bit of a waiting time, and for him, he didn't get a test, he didn't have an opportunity to be tested until the next day, and then waiting for that test result, which he did get the same night, but it was like 8:30-ish, so it was basically two full days of not knowing if he had COVID or not.
Which meant that you had to be a single parent.
Yeah, and it was it was tough because I was not only was I a single parent, but I also needed to like bring food to Garrett. We had him like locked up in
If you know the little gif of a box of shame where the little kid is underneath this box and all he can see it just his little eyes are showing through the slot in the box. That was kind of my life. I was locked upstairs in my office. So, like, locked in my workplace.
Yeah, yeah, he's just sitting there with his work computer staring at him while he's sick.
But, yeah, so you locked me upstairs, and then, you know, you fed me gruel, you know.
What?
Gruel?
Gruel?
You know, like prison food.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. He brought me prison food from time to time.
I brought him chicken noodle soup and crackers and lots of...
Ginger ale.
On the rocks.
Ale on the rocks. Yeah.
And so it was obviously physically draining for me, but it was also very emotionally draining, just not knowing what was going on or if the rest of us also had COVID. But turns out he was negative, so Caleb has gotten to go back to school, so things have gotten better. But those couple of days were just... super draining, and I think kind of exposed maybe some underlying feelings that, at least for me, that I was having of just like anxiety and just frustration of like not being able to do much right now of like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you it's know, just hard.
It's just a hard time.
It's just hard to be a single parent.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, you're used to having me around now.
Yeah.
And then you don't have me, and you're still taking care of me. And so, I mean, that's just difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, and then that on top of the stuff that's going on in our country, in the world, and, you know, and I'm kind of just stuck being, you know, looking at my phone or whatever, and you know, you just see all the stuff that's going on and all the hatred and violence, and you're just like shaking your head. And like, I think a lot of people always look at like the new year, like all of a sudden a new year is going to bring like a whole total change in the world, you know, just from going to the 31st to the 1st. And you know, dadgummit, we live in a broken world, and it's groaning. That's what Paul says, is it's groaning for its release from its bondage. And you know, I see that, I saw that stuff going on, and that's all I could think about, was just like how broken everything is, and how, I mean, the world is enslaved. And you know, it's almost like we've got this facade or this fake mirage of as if we're not enslaved, and like that we're all just like living independently and stuff and whatever. And you know, and that just I just look and I could see whenever Paul talks about the powers. We just finished studying Ephesians on our Sunday morning home church stuff that we're doing. And the powers, Paul talks about the powers so much. And he's talking about the powers of darkness, the authorities of the air. And these spiritual beings that, I mean, from Genesis 3 that we gave our power over to. Our rule, we gave over to it, trusting in it instead of God's word. And ever since then, the world has been enslaved to it. And Paul talks about the powers and how they're ruling over. And our battle as Christians, as followers of Jesus, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers. And I just look around and I see a world that's convinced that we're supposed to be fighting each other. And that's so influenced by the powers and don't even know it. And I think we've gotten to this point where we don't even believe spiritual warfare exists anymore. And so then it's easy to believe that your brother is just evil. And that's what, I mean, that just strikes me. It's like we're cocked and ready to go to fight our brother. And that's not what, you know, Paul, whenever he talks about the way that we're supposed to operate under King Jesus, that, you know, that we're supposed to be announcing to the powers that they actually have lost their power, and that there's a new king, and that's King Jesus. But the way that we announce it, to that we demonstrate it and witness to King Jesus, to the powers, he tells them at the end of Ephesians to clothe yourself with truth and with salvation and with the word, the very utterances of God, the word of God, to strap onto your feet the good news of peace. And that's not a way to fight our human brothers either. Those are things that are for the battle against darkness. And even all of those things, whenever we strap those on as our armor, they're the armor of Messiah. And if we're not emulating Jesus, then we're not actually wearing his armor. We're not actually doing that. And, you know, and the what I saw going on, you know, while I'm sick and while you're dealing with all that stuff, dealing with having to have kids that, you know, are, you know, 4 and 2 that are difficult, and then that stuff is going on in the world, and you know, there's just so much. And I feel like it was just becoming so readily obvious to me after we studied Ephesians, just like, yeah, man, the powers, they're just, they own us. They own it. But this belief and this trust that God is king and that Jesus is king and that he everything on heaven and on earth has been summed up in him, that's been brought together in him, finding a way to trust in that and to announce it to the powers by wearing truth and salvation and the good news of peace and the word of God, that we go out, like that's how we fight the powers. And so, I don't know, that's kind of been on my mind, I guess, over the last week.
Yeah, there's just in general, I have felt just this sense of heaviness from just our own personal sickness experiences, and then just the more general everything that's going on. And it's just kind of like the little things just kind of start to build of just like, oh my goodness, like they just, where when you're already to that level of anxiousness and heaviness, that any little thing then after that can kind of just like really tip you.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where I have felt like I've been over like the past week or so. But I will say the positive thing is no one else in our family has gotten sick. So we think it was something Garrett ate or drank or anxiety or combination of all the things. And then also, we have started watching The Punisher.
Yeah.
Which is, and you know, like it, that feels normal, for us to have a show that we're watching together at night. Because that's just something we really enjoy doing. And we had already seen one of the seasons of The Punisher, and we realized we never saw the second one on Netflix. So we've gone back and are doing that. So there's just been, I don't know, I'm trying to grasp for the little things that bring me joy and just kind of remind myself of those things too, because it is just like, yeah, there's a whole lot of meh going on right now in our world. But there's also little things that we can be grateful for, like watching a Netflix show.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, do you want to do a little bit of a recap?
Yeah. So, we've actually entered into, in Exodus, we're going to pick up in 22 this week. And we've entered into the section of what we commonly know of as the law. And it's called the, in the story, and we're going to see it and, come up in, I think, chapter 24. This whole section is going to be called the Book of the Covenant. That's the traditional thing that it's called, the Book of the Covenant. And in 20, that consists of 21 through 23, somewhere around there, into 23. And, you know, it's a lot of stipulations. It's, you know, if this happens, then that. And if this doesn't happen, then don't do that or whatever. And so, you know, we have a hard time reading this stuff. And anyways, the beginning of 21 starts with that these were the judgments, and these are the regulations that you will set before them. That section, it's the heading over the Book of the Covenant. And John Salehammer talks about this, or just setting it up of saying, you know, this is structured, it's selective, it's not the full law code, it's not a law code. It's representative samples from some code that they might have had at the time. And but these are selective, and they're put into a narrative that we've been reading this whole time. And they're in the narrative for a purpose. And part of his structuring aspect of it, John Salehammer talks about how this section, whenever it says the listing of 42, which is this section that we're in, the 42 laws of the covenant code, equals the numerical value of the title section, and these are the judgments. And anytime in Hebrew, every word in Hebrew has a numerical value. And so what this is, whenever it says these are the regulations, that's the number 42 is there. And then you're going to see 42 regulations follow. And his point is that, and he says, this is not to suggest that secret numerical codes were intended to conceal mysteries within these texts. The use of the numerical values of titles and catchphrases was common, was a common literary device of the time of the composition of Scripture. The point here is that it's structured and it's pulled. It is a sample, and it's something that is specifically structured to reflect, you know, something deeper. And so this is a covenant that God is making, this covenant with the people, and these are the stipulations that follow. It's not meant to be read as a law code. It's supposed to reflect something to you about who God is, and it's supposed to be used for wisdom, that you can read this over and over again and gain something from it, the way that the psalmist talks about and saying, man, I delight in your Torah, that I read it and I can learn something about you from it. And I think last week, the things that we can learn that as we meditate on the Torah, as we meditate on these stipulations or the regulations, or mishpat is is the Hebrew word behind the regulations in verse 21. As we reflect on these, I mean, we can see, like, listen, you know, God cares about how you treat other people. You don't just get, might doesn't make right. You don't get to just treat people how you want to just because they're, quote, your property. And he cares very deeply about how you treat slaves, and that makes sense based off of the context of the story. They were once slaves in Egypt, and whenever this stuff gets repeated in Deuteronomy, it's going to say, you know, do this stuff. But the reason that your slaves are supposed to, you know, like, should be able to observe the Sabbath was because, well, you know, remember, you guys were slaves in Egypt, so act accordingly. And so we can see that God cares very much about how you treat other people. He cares about murder, you know, and, you know, how do we discern whether or not somebody meant to kill somebody? And there seems to be this weighing out of, like, how do we figure that out? But also, you know, how do we deal with whenever somebody hurts another person? Like, how do we work that out? And it's laying out the wisdom of God that... you know, he wants us to care about how we treat other people. We need to be, the people of Israel are to be organized and to have, to demonstrate the wisdom of Yahweh to the world. And the one thing that was good, been a good reflection for me is that in Exodus, kind of the story of Exodus is how God makes himself known. We saw in chapters 1 through 15, God making himself known, both to the Israelites and to Egypt. He makes himself known. It's about, you know, the one of the opening lines, I think it's chapter 3 or 4, or anyways, Pharaoh, and whenever Moses goes to Pharaoh and tells him why he should let him go, he's like, who is God, who is Yahweh that I should know him or listen to his voice? And so the question is, like, how does he come to know God? The whole story of Exodus is about knowing God. And now the Israelites are still coming to know God, and they're going to come to know God even more through his stipulations and being able to meditate over these. But then now they're actually taking an active part instead of just God doing everything, which is what chapters 1 through 15 were about. Now, now he's inviting Israel into that so that they can be his priests. And so that's kind of like this whole section is, I guess I just want to make sure that we understand, like, this all isn't all law code. It is, you know, it's selected and it, for what the purposes of it seems to be, is for them to meditate on it, as they go. And it's written to them in a particular time and, in place, and the way that they can reflect God out to the nations, by acting this sort of way. You know, this is kind of a case study, random case studies and stuff for how to, you know, how do we discern what's right? So anyways, that's where we pick up in chapter 22. We're still very much in this section. Setting is still at Sinai. We're going to be at Sinai all the way through Numbers. So, that's kind of where we are. So you want to read this first section here?
All right. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, he is guilty of bloodshed. A thief must certainly make restitution, but if he has nothing, he must be sold to pay for his theft. If the stolen animal is found alive in his possession, whether ox or donkey or sheep, he must pay back double. If a man grazes his livestock in a field or vineyard and lets them stray and they graze in another man's field, he must make restitution from the best of his own field or vineyard. If a fire breaks out and spreads into thorn bushes so that it burns shocks of grain or standing grain or the whole field, the one who started the fire must make restitution. If a man gives his neighbor silver or goods for safekeeping, and they are stolen from the neighbor's house, the thief, if he is caught, must pay back double. But if the thief is not found, the owner of the house must appear before the judges to determine whether he has laid his hands on the other man's property. In all cases of illegal possession of an ox, a donkey, a sheep, a garment, or any other lost property, about which somebody says, "This is mine," both parties are to bring their cases before the judges. The one whom the judges declare guilty must pay back double to his neighbor. If a man gives a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any other animal to his neighbor for safekeeping, and it dies or is injured or is taken away while no one is looking, the issue between them will be settled by the taking of an oath before the Lord that the neighbor did not lay hands on the other person's property. The owner is to accept this, and no restitution is required. But if the animal was stolen from the neighbor, he must make restitution to the owner. If it was torn to pieces by a wild animal, he shall bring in the remains as evidence, and he will not be required to pay for the torn animal. If a man borrows an animal from his neighbor, and it is injured or dies while the owner is not present, he must make restitution. But if the owner is with the animal, the borrower will not have to pay. If the animal was hired, the money paid for the hire covers the loss. If a man seduces a virgin who is not pledged to be married and sleeps with her, he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he must still pay the bride price for virgins. Do not allow a sorceress to live. Anyone who has sexual relations with an animal must be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed.
Okay. So, again, I mean, continuation of this law code. And I think outright, you know, like if you're, again, reading it in a, whenever you've started like this, read the Bible in the year kind of thing, like this is hard. This is hard to get through. It's obviously old. You know, you're talking about like livestock and how to deal with thieves and but you can tell, like, if you just kind of blanket this section, you can tell this is kind of like, how do we deal with stolen possessions? How do we deal with whenever somebody takes something from somebody? And and it's not like, it's definitely not as harsh as the section before. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I think to me what stands out here is that most of this stuff kind of intellectually makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's much more, I feel like, culturally accepted, like, now, mm-hmm, than some of the stuff in the last, where you have, like, if you curse your mother or father, you will die. Like, right. That just, it feels extreme, where this seems more, quote, fair to us now. Sure. In some ways.
Sure.
But the other thing that I'm noticing as we're going through these chapters after the Ten Commandments is that these seem to be really digging into, like, specific examples of what the Ten Commandments is talking about.
Right.
Because in the Ten Commandments, of course, you have, like, you shall not steal, which, you know, like, that's what this chapter so far is talking about, mm-hmm, in large part, or just like not coveting your neighbor's stuff. There, you know, and I think that gets to the heart of a thief, mm-hmm, innocent, you know, yeah, is that you want something that someone else has and you're willing to take it or whatever. And so I have found that to be really like a neat thing of, yeah, this is just like digging for chapter 21, chapter 22 that we're in now, and then moving on to chapter 20. Is it just through 23?
I think it's through the end of 23, maybe middle of 23.
So just as we're doing these following chapters of just kind of connecting these back and keeping in mind the Ten Commandments that came before this and how it is very much consistent with the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a lot like, here's what this looks like.
Like in practice.
In practice, in life in the land. It's, yeah, not extent, it's not... Again, it's not comprehensive. It's examples of, yeah, okay, if this type of thing happened, how would, you know, what's maybe a good way to deal with it? Well, you know, if a thief tries to steal something, then, you know, don't just make him give it back. Like, he still needs to pay something more to, I guess, to kind of
make up for the fact that you were without it.
Yeah, otherwise it's just like, oh, okay, so I can just free reign steal stuff because, yeah, all I got to do is just give it back.
Yeah, there's no...
So there's got to be some consequence to it. And so that's kind of the wisdom that's being developed here. And that, I guess, it just feels more straightforward to us because we do deal with theft. You know, we do, that is something that we come into contact with more on a regular basis.
But, and, like, again, it's like, yeah, obviously this isn't every circumstance that could possibly come up. I mean, this is 20 verses, so this is not accounting for every possible situation of theft of property or damaging property or whatever.
Right.
And so I think that that is probably the single most helpful thing for me to realize is, like, take a step back while some of this feels like awfully specific of, like, this is what you should do when this happens. And that, and even more so for, I think, for chapter 21, that it's like, okay, but this isn't, this is here for wisdom.
Right.
This is not an all-inclusive list.
Right.
It's because there's so many situations that
it's something
here
to be studied over and over and over again. And then, you know, it's just, again, to glean wisdom. And and obviously, this actually isn't for the moment. This is for the time in the land. You know, this has a very land of Canaan forward look, because they don't own vineyards.
Yeah.
And yet we're sitting here talking about, like, if a vineyard, if somebody lights a fire and it gets into somebody else's area, you know.
It's like, wait, we're on the side of a mountain, like, wandering through the wilderness right
That's
now.
Not something that's applicable to them right now. It's something that's very much looking forward to the land. And so it seems odd for its context, but again, it's something that's looking forward.
Isn't that another cool thing of just, like, the underlying message here is, like, God's going to keep his promise. Like, you are going to make it to the promised land.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a cool undertone here of just, like, yeah, this is what you're going to, these are the kind of instructions or wisdom that you are going to need when you reach this place that I've promised you, that I've made an oath to you.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, another neat aspect of it. I mean, some of this stuff obviously would apply to them wherever they are.
Mm-hmm.
But, like you were saying with vineyards, that seems to be a more forward-looking
thing. It presumes life in the land. And that means that God, you know, it's like an assumption that God's going to fulfill his promise.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting underlying undercurrent, I suppose, of it. I think a lot of this, again, it's just dealing with, you know, how do we discern and figure out what to do about stolen goods. Obviously, it's not worth a life. You know, like, stealing possessions is not worth a life. You know, and one thing I didn't mention last week, whenever we talk about eye for eye, tooth for tooth and stuff, that gets a really bad rap, I feel like, because, you know, it's like, I think I want to say it's like Gandhi, but I'm not sure. I don't know. But, like, you hear the phrase thrown out around a bunch of, you know, eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. And that's just not the case. What that is about is that you can't, it's about the punishment fitting the crime, and that having equal, you know, restitution that matches the thing that was taken, matches the crime that was performed. In that, okay, so if I steal something from you, it doesn't mean that you get to then, you know, beat my child to death. You know, like, which is, well, I mean, but, like, that's how things escalate. Think about how things really happen in the real world, is that, you know, if you tick somebody off, they don't want to just get back at you. They want to escalate it. They want to say, like, I'm not only going to get back at you for the thing that you did, but I'm going to take it to the next level. And the whole thing with that is, like, limiting that and saying, no, you know, like, the punishment should fit the crime. Things that happen, it doesn't mean that you get to, you know, that if so, it, I mean, it, I guess in the last section, if somebody kills your brother, that you get to kill their family. You know, like, it doesn't, that, I mean, but that's how things happen whenever things are just let loose and chaos reigns. Mm-hmm. And when might makes right, that's the way that humanity operates, because we live in a broken world. We escalate things. And so it's limiting that and saying, no, punishment fits the crime. It's trying to make things fair and make sense. I mean, obviously, you know, like, we believe in that. We do. We think that, you know, I guess in our culture, we think that punishment should fit the crime. We don't, You know, we don't want it to go beyond what it should. And so that's what that's about. It's not about saying, well, you know, you took my eye, I'm going to take your eye. It's about it, and then it just proceeds on and on and on. That's not the way that is working. That's not the wisdom that's there. So anyways, that I think that fits here by mentioning that notice that stolen goods don't mean that, okay, now take the thief's life, you know, yeah. because he stole an ox.
Right.
You know, or because he killed an ox. You don't take a person's life for that. Anyways, that I think that's kind of what's going on here with that, or how you see the tone change
mm-hmm.
About it. And then usually in the last four here, translators usually kind of break that off into they don't really know. It's kind of like miscellaneous stuff that seems like it doesn't make sense. I will say that I do think that 16 and 17 belongs with the previous section. It feels like a property thing, and that I think that's probably the most uncomfortable thing to us in this chapter, yeah. is this idea of the virgin daughter, of this daughter being property of the father. Again, it's in their cultural river. This makes sense. And, you know, and it's about, you know, a man, you know, he works out with somebody that is, you don't have like the idea of falling in love with somebody, you know, and
it's like not a thing here.
No, that's just not in this cultural river.
Mm-hmm.
And so to expect that to be there is just like, you can't expect that to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And instead it's about, okay, well, what happens if a man, you know, that he does get with this girl, and this isn't rape. This isn't, we're talking about a man seduces a virgin means that there's some agreement here between the two of them that this is a thing that they're doing. And it's like, okay, what happens whenever that happens, whenever a father has been maybe, you know, working with the dude two fields down to try to, you know, saying, hey, let's get together. Our families are going to come together. You know, my daughter is going to be, you know, going to marry your son. And then we're going to kind of work together and become, you know, a group. And so that's like kind of how things worked. And so whenever he's been working on that, and then all of a sudden this dude out of left field comes and, you know, seduces your daughter and sleeps with her. Now you can't make that deal anymore that you had with your friend down the street, you know, you were going to come into business with and stuff. And so it's saying, okay, what do we do with situations like that?
And actually for me, I feel like this is, I don't know, we kind of talked about this last chapter of like giving rights to the people who you wouldn't expect to have rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so like for the virgin to now all of a sudden be like, okay, I am going to be somebody's wife, I feel like gives her a little bit of protection of like, okay, now she's underneath someone to be taken care of by them.
Yeah.
Like she has like a family unit. She has an opportunity to have children, specifically sons, that would be a big deal for her to yeah. have in this time. And so like I see that as like a positive thing for her. And the other thing that I see as a positive is it mentions the father can refuse to give her to him, but it doesn't mention anything about like the man being able to like refuse to have her as his wife.
There are two options.
Yeah, it's like
there are two options. Either the man takes her in and takes care of her, or the father says no,
yeah,
she's still going to be in my house, but you still have to give me the bride price.
Yeah.
And so there's a in either sense here, the woman is not left out in the cold.
Right.
She's
I guess
not,
that's, and that's yeah. I guess what I'm getting at is like it seems like it's an okay outcome for her either way.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's a point where she's getting left in the cold. By this wisdom here, I mean it seems like, hey, listen, you know, if this happens, you know, she needs to be taken care of. And you know, still if the father doesn't think this is a good dude for her to be with, you know, that's like it's not part of a good family or whatever, you know, I don't know how you discern that. But, you know, if he makes that decision, he can still say, but you still owe me the bride price. You know, it's a way of taking care of the daughter, you know, in that situation as well. So in either case, she's taken care of, and I think that's the point. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it's protection of, I guess the virgin daughter is kind of goods, I suppose, to the father, because it's a way that he makes unions between other people, mm-hmm. and with other people that we can work together. So I think it belongs with it. A lot of translations separate it out because it feels really uncomfortable to us to say that. But I think that's really what's happening. And then you kind of have these three random ones of, well, they seem random, I guess, at first, but you will not let a witch live. Anyone lying with an animal will surely be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to the gods, not to Yahweh, to him alone, will be destroyed. And I think these three kind of come together, and maybe hinting towards more Canaanite worship, again, looking more towards the land, living in the land, and thinking more towards that, and that maybe these are things that are going on in Canaan that he does, that just do not need to be reflected in Israel. This is a way that they become different. And the witch aspect of it, it's feminine, but primarily I think it's because most sorcerers are going to be women. There's already been sorcerers in this. It's the same word, which is the people that work for Pharaoh. But here it's feminine. But I don't think that excludes the masculine ones. It's just that I think that whenever you get into the land, the majority of the sorcerers are going to be women. And so that's probably why that gender gets put there. And unfortunately, that's been taken in a way that has killed a lot of people. Anyways, so I think these are really looking forward to Canaan. And also reminding them that, listen, Yahweh is your God.
Yeah, and I mean, verse 20 goes straight back to the Ten Commandments.
That's right.
Have no other gods before me. Don't make for yourself an idol. Like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that one, in verse 20, I'm like, yeah, we've kind of already covered that in the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
But, yeah. All right.
Okay, so let's keep going. Verse 21. And you will not mistreat an alien. And you will not oppress him, because you were aliens in the land of Egypt. You will not afflict any widow or orphan. If you indeed afflict him, yes. If he cries out at all to me, I will certainly hear his cry of distress. And I will become angry. And I will kill you with the sword. And your wives will be widows, and your children orphans. If you lend money to my people, to the needy with you, you will not be to him as a creditor. You will not charge him interest. If indeed you require the cloak of your neighbor as a pledge, you will return it to him at sundown, because it is his only garment. It is his cloak for his skin. And what will he sleep? And when he cries out to me, I will hear, because I am gracious. You will not curse God, and you will not curse a leader among your people. You will not delay the fullness of your harvest, and the juice from your press. You will give me the firstborn of your sons. You will do likewise for your ox and for your sheep and goats. 7 days it will be with its mother. On the eighth, you will give it to me. And you will be men of holiness for me. And you will not eat meat from a carcass mangled in the field. You will throw it to the dog.
So I really, really loved this section.
Mm-hmm.
Just starting off in verse 21 with, like, reminding them of, do not mistreat an alien or oppress him, for you were aliens in Egypt. Reminding them of where they came from. Reminding them of the oppression and the unfair situations that they faced while they were in Egypt. But really, in this whole section, what stood out to me was the taking care, well, it's do not take advantage of a widow or an orphan. And there was a time several years ago when Garrett and I were in the youth group where we had a service project group called Crew 127, And that was based on James 1:27, which says, "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world." And so when I read this, it took me straight to James and realizing then what James was probably thinking about when he, I say James, yeah. What he was probably thinking about when he wrote this, and just how that this is something that is woven throughout Scripture of taking care of widows and orphans, and just thinking about the culture of that time and how vulnerable that group of people would be in this, you know, in their society of just having nothing and it just kind of being poor and looked down upon. And so that got me thinking too about Jesus talking about the least of these. So like in Matthew 25, 40 through 45, of just, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. Then he will say to those on the left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. They also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you? He will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of these least of these, you did not do for me. And so I feel like this is all getting back to the heart of what's going on here in Exodus of, yeah, it's specifically mentioning orphans and widows, but those are the people that are the least of these. And then you also have, you know, people who are needy and needing money. I mean, these are the least of these that I feel like is what's being talked about in Matthew, and that these are the people we need to take care of and look after. And so I just thought those connections were really neat.
Well, I mean, who ends up, if they don't take care of them, who ends up taking care of them in this? I mean, God ends up taking care of them, and it's like a protective father, mm-hmm. you know, in this of like, if you mistreat them, I'm coming for you.
Yeah.
And if you mistreat them, you're not bearing my name.
Right.
You know, this section to me, you're right. This is interwoven through Scripture of taking care of the widow and the orphan together. If you go search widow and orphan throughout the Scriptures, they're paired together in single verses 62 different times. Only one of those times is in the New Testament. And I just say that to say we often think about the New Testament as like, oh, that's the God of love. 61 times it is the widow and the orphan is talked about in the Hebrew Scriptures about how to, like, why it's important to take care of them. Mm-hmm. And one time in James that you just read is talked about. You know, and that's not to say it's not worried about in the New Testament, but the Hebrew Scriptures carry the God of love just as much as the New Testament. Mm-hmm. I just want to highlight that. And I mean, and these are the people that, I mean, yes, these are the people that don't have anybody to represent them. And so who represents them? God does. And everything is based off of, you were aliens in Egypt, so don't be a jerk, you know? Yeah. Don't be the person that you wanted Egypt, you wanted Egypt to be to you, and instead take care of them. And those are the people that wouldn't have any rights whenever they come into your place. And so, and then the widows and the orphans. I mean, think about Ruth. Think about what's mm-hmm. happening with Ruth. When we read that story, Boaz is like this, you know, exemplary Torah abide her. And what does he do? He not only follows the Torah, he takes the Torah to the next level and says, this is the heart of what God wanted me to do, was to take care of this woman, mm-hmm. To take care of these women in their distress. And So, you know,
I mean, it's basically a whole book about widows being taken care of.
That's right. That's exactly what it is. And how Boaz is representing God. He's the righteous character in that. Ruth is too, a righteous character in that story. But very much, what's being poured out here is that God very much cares about the afflicted, who are the widows and the orphans and the aliens, and making sure that they have what they need. And he uses the language that's used earlier in Exodus to describe them, which is when they cry out. When they cry out in distress, I'm going to hear them. Just like I heard your cries, Israel. I heard your cries, and just like I heard your cries, if they cry out to me, I'm going to hear their cries. And you remember what happened to Egypt, right? And so, it's just this, it's taking it very, very seriously. If you mistreat the widow and the orphan, what happened to Egypt will happen to you. It's a God of judgment, but it's very much wrapped up in the God of love that cares for these people.
Don't you kind of love, how can you not love a God who is so protective and love? Like, if we see that in a movie where there's mm-hmm. this really protective character over vulnerable people, we are like, yes, make him king. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, and that's what this is.
Yeah.
And so that's just, I don't know. It's just awesome to me. I love this section because I can see how this is woven throughout scripture. It doesn't feel, maybe it's because of everything that we've read, but it doesn't feel, like harsh to me. I think maybe it used to when I read this, I would be like, I will kill you with the sword. What? Like, but now I'm like, no, he's expressing how much he loves these people and how he would do anything to protect them.
Yeah.
Because they're vulnerable and they are crying out to God. They're crying out to him.
And how important it is that Israel be his representative.
Right.
And do that themselves and not require his intervention.
Right.
With it. It needs to be a thing. Now they are being able to make God known. How do they make God known? How do they show the world who God is and make him known to them? Well, it's taking care of the widow and the orphan.
Yeah.
And the alien among you.
I do want to mention verse 28. I think this is something that could definitely be taken out of context. And you had mentioned something to me the other day about this that kind of helped make sense of this to me of, do not blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people. And I'm specifically mentioning the curse the ruler of your people because I think that could be taken wildly out of context of like whoever the, and you know, of like, don't curse the president of the United States. We'll just go there.
I think if he could make it that way, he would.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that we should curse the president. I'm not saying we should curse the president of the United States.
Sure.
But what is so interesting here is Garrett and I were talking about how this is Israel. This is a people who are entered into a covenant with God.
Yeah.
And so the leader, and we kind of talked about how the ruler of your people here might kind of be in the same sense of like elders in the church have like a higher expectation.
There's more demanded of them. There's more responsibility on their shoulders.
That they, to do not curse the ruler of your people, the idea is that those people, that the ruler of Israel in this case would be someone who is doing the right things and, you know, like in covenant with God.
Well, I think maybe more importantly is the person that they answer to is God.
God, yeah.
And that they may not do everything right, and they're certainly not going to do everything right. But take example from David, in that Saul was a total jerk to him. And he refused to curse Saul, because Saul was an anointed one of God. And even though Saul was an awful person to David, he refused. He was just like, no. And even and whenever Saul does get killed, the guy that comes to announce it to David, he tells him that he killed him. He didn't actually kill Saul, but he's looking for honor from David. And he tells David, he thinks that he's going to get honor from David by telling him, I killed Saul. You know, and he's like, who do you think you are killing the anointed one of God? And what he thought is going to bring him honor actually brings about his death. And you can read that, I think that's beginning of 2 Samuel. But anyways, so think about it like that, of that the example that we have, I think, is of David, of not cursing Saul, even though he deserved it. And why? Because Saul is subject to Yahweh. And so he's going to get his. In the decisions that he makes, he's going to get his. And so instead, it's better to be respectful. It's better to honor those people in position. You know, I think that rubs us as Americans, you know, like we feel very like, no, call out your leaders and all this stuff. And I don't know that that's wrong. It's just, you know, we think about that more from the United States, and leadership in the United States and whether or not they should be. The United States is not in covenant with God. But the church is, you know, and so like whenever we start thinking about our elders and the leaders in the church, that we need to be respectful of that, and that they, you know, the idea is they have gotten to that place because of they have honored God in their life, and so to honor them, and you know what, let God deal with the things that they do or don't do that are right or wrong.
So
that's hard for us. It is really hard for us to step back and be like David and say, listen, whenever my time has come to be, you know, not that I, that me, Garrett, is going to be king, you know, like, but when, you know, but when my time, when their time is up and my time has come, you know, God's going to deal with all of that. Yeah. And that's what David does. That's his example that we get whenever David is good and he's doing things the way that he's supposed to be before Yahweh. He's letting Saul go about his business. When he has a chance to kill him, he says, no, thank you. No, that's God's role. And so I think that's the example that just comes to mind with that. And then this last section of making sure that we give the first fruits, and saying, you know, this, the first of everything belongs to God because everything comes from God, and remembering that, and, even to our firstborn sons, which they can redeem. That's back in Exodus 13 ish. About redeeming the sons with the lamb. And that's pretty common practice. And then the idea of the 7 days to be with his mother and the eighth seems to reflect some aspects of circumcision and stuff and dedicating and consecrating something to God. And then the last part, just really pointed, you will not eat meat from a carcass mangled in the field. You will throw it to the dog. In other words, don't eat roadkill.
Way to end the chapter.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, maybe some aspect of that is that if we're eating a carcass mangled in the field, that, like, we're not trusting that God can give us, I don't know, maybe, like, that's just something that I think that needs to be contemplated. Mm-hmm. It's one of those meditation things. It's like, what is this? Like, I don't typically run into a dead carcass in the middle of the field. Right. What's going on with that? Maybe it has some aspect of being like, you know, trusting that God's going to provide for you, you know, in a reasonable way, I suppose. I don't know.
It's just an interesting verse because you read, you are to be my holy people, so do not, and ... like you're expecting something different than this. So it's just kind of interesting that it's sort of thrown in here, but definitely something to kind of reflect on. I think I typically just kind of like gloss over these things, but just trying to think through it more of like, is it because it's something that it wouldn't be good for our bodies, like a health concern, or, you know, or what Garrett was talking about. It's just something to kind of think about and meditate on.
I think it's just something that you kind of come to a situation and you're like, oh, that's kind of like that. Paul would do that whenever he's talking about church leadership and paying your ministers and things like that. He would say, you know, another law from the code is that, you know, don't muzzle the ox while it's treading out grain. And I never really understood that until reflecting on that recently. But, I mean, he's taking a law that obviously has nothing to do with church leadership and saying, oh, well, you know, it's kind of like that in that, listen, while an ox is treading out grain, let it reap rewards of its work as well. You know, that it can actually, I mean, you're talking about an ox that's going, round and round with a millstone or something, that you're whatever, that's treading, getting the grains out of wheat or whatnot, and letting it eat from the fruits of its labor, that fuels it. It allows the thing that fuels you, the thing that it's doing that is going to fuel you, you allow it to fuel itself from that too. And just the same way, whenever, I guess, pastors and stuff work, that, you know, like, don't let it go unpaid. Like, let them earn something, too, from it, just the way that you do whenever you're given the wisdom that they provide you. And so, anyways, I think that's maybe one of those that you just kind of, you have kind of tucked away, and then maybe one day it'll come to you and be like, oh, yeah, that's kind of like not throwing, you know, or not eating a dead carcass on the side of the road or in the middle of the field. And so, you know, I think it's just one of those things you meditate over, and one day it might just be like, oh, yeah, this is kind of like that. Mm-hmm. So, anyways, I just kind of want to end with this. You know what? The longest psalm in the Bible, or in the book of Psalms, is Psalm 119. And I think it, let me see. Psalm 119, I think it's 179 verses. 119. Yeah, I think it's 179 verses. And man, its only subject seems to be 176 verses. 176 verses. And its subject is the law and how much the psalmist loves the law. He loves the Torah. And how he loves reflecting on it and reading it and just loving it. And so longest psalm in the Bible is about like how this dude reads the Torah and just eats it up and just thinks the world of it and consumes it and just delights in it. And so I'm just going to read a little section from it. I'm not going to read 176 verses, but I'm going to read a little section of it. This is from a book by Ross Blackburn, The God Who Makes Himself Known. And he quotes this section. He says, this is Psalm 119, 129 through 136. Your testimonies are wonderful. Therefore, my soul keeps them. The unfolding of your words gives light. It imparts understanding to the simple. I open my mouth and I pant because I long for your commandments. Turn to me and be gracious to me, as is your way with those who love your name. Keep steady my steps according to your promise, and let no iniquity get dominion over me. Redeem me from man's oppression, that I may keep your precepts. Make your face shine upon your servant, and teach me your statutes. My eyes shed streams of tears, because people do not keep your law. And this is what Blackburn writes. He says, what is true for contemporary culture has surely been true since Genesis 3. Humanity carries a deep suspicion, even resentment for law, particularly God's law. Yet, for the psalmist, the law is wonderful, bringing life, giving light and understanding to the simple, and keeping one from iniquity. The language of desire could not be stronger. I open my mouth and pant because I long for your commandments. Three matters are particularly noteworthy. First, the psalmist loves the Lord, which he articulates in terms of the Lord's name. A reading of Psalm 119 reveals a man who loves the law of the Lord precisely because he loves the Lord. and therefore the Lord's name. Secondly, Psalm 119 suggests no tension between salvation and the law. In fact, the psalmist seeks deliverance so that he might obey the law. For the law for him is freedom. The Lord is both the Redeemer and the giver of law, and the psalmist rejoices in both. Finally, for all the joy the psalmist finds in the Lord of his law, all is not well. My eyes shed streams of tears because people do not keep your law. Here the psalmist shares the perspective of the Old Testament itself, which mourns sin and injustice in the earth, and looks forward to the day when all nations will come to Jerusalem, saying, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths." All is not as it should be. Implicit in the psalmist's words is mission.